This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at price that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
All right, welcome back. SI Boxing Podcast. We are loaded up this week. A lot going on in the boxing world. You got Jerron Ennis with a step-up fight against Sergey Lipinets. Joe Smith, he fights for a light heavyweight title this weekend. I want to look back too at Jamel Herring's win against Carl Frampton this past weekend. Dan Rayfield, longtime boxing writer, currently working over at BoxingScene.com and RingTV.com. He joins me to talk about that and much more. A little bit later on, Jamel Herring, the 130-pound champion, he drops in and we talk about his big win over Frampton, why he prefers a fight against Oscar Valdez over Shakur Stevenson, and why he's willing to drop his belt to get it. After that, Jerron Ennis, welterweight contender. He has got that big fight against Lipinets. Talk to Jerron about his path to this point, what he thinks about some of his peers, like Ryan Garcia and Virgil Ortiz, taking step-up fights, what the next big fight is for him, and really, is it possible we could see Ennis against Ortiz at some point before the end of 2022? I talked to him about that and much more. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way to support it. Get over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to the show.
Ever been ringside and got blood on you?
Oh, all the time.
This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
Anthony Joshua is a composed and ferocious finisher. Watch this.
Andy Ruiz is the heavyweight champion.
Hosted by SI's Chris Mannix.
No, it's really embarrassing.
That was my moment.
Now with interviews, analysis, and everything going on in the world of boxing.
When you have talent, you are given another chance.
Here's Chris Mannix.
All right, lot to get to in the world of boxing. Had an interesting fight this past weekend. Several good ones coming up this weekend. Great time to catch up with my friend Dan Rayfield. He's a great job covering boxing for BoxingScene.com, RingTV.com. You can sign up for Dan's newsletter. It's excellent. Comes out regularly, daily at least, and sometimes a little bit more. Whenever there's big news that comes out, check Dan out on Twitter at DanRayfield1. Dan, what's up, man?
Living the dream, Chris, and you've been counting the moments down until we could do the podcast together.
Oh, it is here, my friend. It is here once again. And before we get to the fights this weekend, and there are some good ones, I think interesting for a couple of reasons each one, let's look back for a second at the 130-pound fight between Jamel Herring and Carl Frampton this past weekend. You know, during fight week, at different times, Frampton was considered a favorite. Oddsmakers at one point had Frampton as the favorite of that fight. On fight night, looked entirely different. Jamel Herring was pretty much dominant throughout, dropped Frampton a couple of times before the stoppage occurred in that seventh round. I guess start with that. What did you think of Herring's performance and how the fight played out?
Well, I thought it was a sixth round stoppage, but be that as it may. Look, it was a great performance. I think the reason that Carl was probably the favorite, and, you know, not to brag, but I mean, I did pick Herring. I know a lot of people didn't necessarily do that. I was picking Herring pretty much all the way, no disrespect to Frampton. But I think the reason why Frampton was considered the favorite in that fight is a couple of reasons. One, he has a bigger name. He's been a champion in two weight classes. He's had the much bigger fights and won some of them. And people also look at what happened with Jermell Herring in his previous fight. And as the saying goes, and more so maybe in boxing than just about any other sport, you're only as good as your last fight. And he did not look that good, you know, in the Oquendo fight that he had previously. Now, he won that fight, but it was a messy disqualification. He's, you know, a lot of people thought he kind of quit because of the cut on his eye, even though it was ruled, you know, from a headbutt and the opponent got disqualified. But I think people need to remember, first of all, you're not going to be brilliant every night, and he still, whatever you say about it, he still won the fight. And two, you know, I'm not to discount it, but he was coming off a bout of COVID-19, and that you know, surely diminished him a little bit, the same like it probably did with, say, Povetkin in his recent fight. I mean, it's not an easy situation when you have that and you're just a few weeks removed from coming back into a, you know, a very, you know, hard sport like boxing. But I thought that Herring just looked absolutely tremendous. He used his height. He used his reach advantage, took care of business in a big way.
I agree with everything you said there. And I would add to it that, you know, one takeaway I had was weight classes matter. And, you know, Herring is a legitimate 130 pounder, came down, you know, a couple of years ago from 135 to 130. He is a big, sturdy guy at that 130 pound weight limit. Whereas Frampton was fighting really for the first time as a full fledged 130 pounder. And you could see that in the ring. Frampton, yeah, to me, looked like 122 pounder coming up. And that was Frampton's best weight class, 122.
Yeah, I was going to say,
Herring's physicality was just an overriding factor.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, even Frampton as a featherweight, he, you know, I know he won a world title in that weight class and he fought a great matchup with Leo Santa Cruz. And, you know, you ended up winning Fighter of the Year in 2016, mainly because of that victory. But I never really thought of him as like a legit solid featherweight anyway. He was very good in the featherweight division. He got the wins to prove it, but I still always kind of thought of him as a 22 pounder. And like you said, now he come all the way up to 130 against a guy that had come down from 135 with that reach, with that height. You know, Jermell has done a great job, you know, by switching his situation up. You know, he was with PBC for a while. That did not work out for him. He left on good terms and he joined up with the BOMAC, Brian McIntyre group, worked with Terrence Crawford and, you know, with their team. And, you know, I think that change of scenery and the fact that people at Top Rank and McIntyre and Terrence Crawford, they believed in him. And that means something sometimes. I mean, you know, obviously boxing is a lot of it's physical, but a lot of it's mental also. And a fighter, if he has that confidence, you know, you have the right trainer and the right promotional situation, you know, it can bring out the best in you. And I truly believe that Jermell Herring, who had a couple of, you know, not, you know, forgettable kind of losses against just regular kind of opponents, I believe that he, you know, was in the right situation. And everybody around him and his team have gotten the most out of his ability.
Yeah, it just shows the value in shaking things up sometimes. You know, he gets knocked out by Denis Shafikov. He loses a fight to Ladarius Miller. It looks like, you know, he's in his early, almost mid-30s at that point. It looks like his career is going towards opponent territory. And then he wins the championship against Ito. And now he's positioned himself for a significant fight. So let's talk about that fight, Dan. In the aftermath of defeating Carl Frampton, it was pretty clear what direction Jermell Herring wanted to go. He wanted a fight against Oscar Valdez. He clearly can get the fight against Oscar Valdez. Valdez and Herring are both promoted by Top Rank. That is a very makeable fight on that side of the street. The question will be, can he do it as the WBO's 130-pound title holder? In the immediate aftermath of defeating Frampton, the WBO reaffirmed its position that Herring had to defend his title, presumably against Shakur Stevenson, if Shakur wins his fight in mid-June. How do you think this all plays out with Herring, Stevenson, Valdez, and that WBO title?
I would tend to believe that it's going to be a title that's going to be vacated and that, you know, if he does in fact fight Oscar Valdez, it will just be for Valdez's WBC belt, and the winner of Shakur's fight against the fighter from South Africa in June will then win the vacant title. Now, at the moment, you know, that would be for the interim title. Shakur has already stepped aside to allow the Frampton and Herring fight, and he's in a hurry to get the title. So unless there's some kind of reason or offer or something that is worthwhile for Stevenson and his side to allow another interim fight, I believe that the title will be
vacant. Do you think there is? Do you think there will be?
You know, I really don't know about that. I mean, you can't underestimate the fact that Top Rank works with both of them, and so maybe they could, you know, sort of work out some kind of arrangement. But it certainly, if he does vacate the title and challenge Valdez, which is a good fight, belt or no belt, in terms of Herring, you know, it's still going to be for the Valdez title. It's not an unprecedented situation. There's been plenty of times I can think of where there's been a desire for a unification, and for whatever reason, because the politics involved, the guy ended up giving up a belt, so it was only for the other fighter's title. And I can think of a couple examples. When Diego Corrales fought Floyd Mayweather, you know, it should have been a WBC-IBF unification at 130, same weight class. But Diego Corrales ended up giving up that title instead of a mandatory fight. You know, when Vernon Forrest fought against Sugar Shane Mosley, should have been a unification fight, but he gave up the IBF title because he'd rather make, like, you know, $1.5 million or $2 million than $200,000 against the Italian fighter Michele Picciarillo, if I remember correctly. And there's plenty of examples like that you can go through where it just makes sense from the fan desire, from certainly the TV company that's going to show the fight, certainly from the purse point of view from the fighter, they just give up the title. I mean, you know, Herring, he won it. He's defended it a few times. There's no doubt that he's one of the top few guys in 130 pounds in the world. And, you know, is anybody going to not tune in to see Herring fight Valdez just because it's not to unify the belts? You know, if you're a boxing fan, you know the deal. You know, Shakur is going to go on, probably win that title and become one of the top fighters out there. And, you know, Herring will go and make a lot of money against Valdez if they can make that happen. So, you know, would you like to see it for the unification? Of course. But in the end, does it really make that big of a difference? I don't think so. I'd just like to see the fight. And they still got a title at stake. And look, Valdez is considered, you know, the champion, if you will, of that division at the moment anyway. So let's get it on.
Look, we were just talking about a situation like this potentially unfolding in the Superfly division with Chocolatito and Juan Francisco Estrada. I mean, everybody wanted to see an immediate rematch, but there was the Sorungvisai mandatory for the WBC belt. I think if the WBC didn't get involved and take us into their land of make-believe with the franchise championship, we probably would have seen Estrada drop that WBC belt and just fight Chocolatito for that WBA title in a fight that would have netted him significantly more money than a Sorungvisai matchup. So I'm with you. I don't think that titles matter. Money matters. Prestige matters. And it's pretty clear Herring knows that the most money he can make is going up against Oscar Valdez right now. And Dan, if he happens to win that fight, at this point, I'm not putting anything past Jamel Herring. If he wins that fight, a Shakur fight in 2022 is worth a lot more than it's worth right now.
And I just never got the feeling from day one that Herring, they didn't want to mess around with Shakur Stevenson. You know, look, no disrespect to Herring, but that's a bad fight for him. That's a bad fight for most guys in the 130-pound weight class, in my estimation. And so why mess around with that fight where, you know, you'll make a payday, but you can make certainly much more if you can fight Valdez. And I would suspect, honestly, that if he were to beat a Valdez, A, maybe there'd be a rematch. On B, at that point, you know, Herring's already talked about wanting to move up to lightweight. You know, it's not like he makes 130 that easily. He'd probably looking at the fact if he were to defeat Valdez, there might be, you know, a good offer for him to have a fight in the 135 weight class. So, you know, I don't think we're ever seeing him in the ring with Shakur Stevenson. I hope we see him in the ring with Oscar Valdez.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And I think that's the most likely scenario for later on this year. All right, let's talk about the fights this weekend. Let's begin with the welterweight fight over on Showtime, where Jerron Ennis will, you know, take his step-up opportunity. We saw it with Ryan Garcia in January with Luke Campbell. We saw it in March with Virgil Ortiz and Maurice Hooker. Now we're seeing it on some level with Jerron Ennis and Sergey Lipinets, the toughest opponent of Ennis's career, the biggest name he could potentially add on his resume. Let's start with Ennis's talent, Dan. You've been ranking prospects for a long time at ESPN and now at other outlets. How good is Jerron Ennis? How would you evaluate him as a prospect?
Very simple. At the end of 2020, if I was still doing the Prospect of the Year award for ESPN, which I'm not anymore, but I still did it on my own. I considered John Ennis, who was in my mind, he was a candidate that could have been the prospect of the year in 2019. I had him as the prospect of the year at the end of 2020. He's a fantastic talent, comes from a boxing family, been around the gyms in Philadelphia with so many top guys, you know, in terms of learning and sparring and, you know, just soaking it in. You know, he can do a lot of stuff, and I've seen him fight many times. I've seen him in person. I've seen him on television. He's the real deal. And I think that, you know, you mentioned the other two guys that stepped up, Virgil Ortiz, Ryan Garcia. You know, we're seeing all these guys who are in their early 20s, 21, 22, 23. A lot of them are taking those steps up. Now, they may not be fighting each other yet, and hopefully we'll get to that in some of these different weight classes, particularly at lightweight. But in terms of Ennis taking on Lipinets, who's, you know, a tough, solid, good veteran, a former title holder at 140, you know, that's a legit step up. But I think Jaron Ennis is up to the task in a big way. You know, I think this kid's going all the way in my mind.
What kind of test are you expecting Lipinets to give him? Because Lipinets is a fairly accomplished guy. He has a world championship at 140, as you said. He fought Mikey Garcia, lost unanimous decision, but bounced back from that with a terrific win over Lamont Peterson, you know, just about a year or so later. How big, you know, Lipinets, Dan, it seems like he wants to turn this fight into a brawl. I'm not so sure that's good for a guy that's been campaigning at 140 for a while, but he seems to want to turn this into a toe-to-toe slugfest with Jaron Ennis. What are you expecting from Lipinets?
Well, that's one of the things about Ennis that makes him such an appealing prospect, because he's got great boxing skills, but I think, you know, it's, and I hope it doesn't turn out this way, but as an example, I'm not saying they're the same fighter, but I think about Meldrick Taylor, great Philadelphia fighter, Olympic gold medalist, 140-pound world champion. He was a brilliant, brilliant boxer, but he was a Philly guy in his heart. He liked to fight. So while he could box, he loved to get in there and mix it up, and that's what made him so fan-friendly and why everybody, you know, enjoyed watching his fights. Ennis reminds me a little bit like that, because he's got the skills, but his mind says, let me get in there and fight the guy. So he, I think, is capable of doing both. If Lipinets wants to make it a you know, a slugfest like that, it probably would behoove Ennis to box a little bit more. But I wouldn't shock me if he got into that kind of fight, you know, feeling like he can handle it. I think whether it becomes a brawl or it becomes a boxing match, Jaron Ennis is going to handle Sergey Lipinets. I think he's going to do it pretty easily. I mean, I know that may sound crazy, but I think Ennis wins big on the weekend.
Yeah, I think this is a great chance for him to not only win big, but look spectacular.
Well, I'm not sure what Lipinets can do to win the fight, you know, other than land like the perfect shot. But I don't consider Lipinets to be this devastating one-punch knockout artist. Jaron Ennis' defense is sound, so I don't see him getting hit too clean, too flush, too often. And in terms of just their boxing abilities, I think Jaron Ennis blows him away in the skill department and the speed department. So I just not sure what category, other than if you just land, you never can underestimate the guy's heart either. So if it gets into that kind of brawl, we haven't seen Ennis, you know, in the crucible yet. And that's what Lipinets' job is to do on Saturday, is to put Jaron Ennis in an uncomfortable position, put him in the crucible of that fight and see if he can, you know, outgut him, outheart him. I just don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're going to have to be in a position where you're going to have to learn about Jaron Ennis' heart necessarily, because I think the skill department is so superior to what Lipinets brings to the table. I just, you know, I think we'll get a pretty good fight, but I think in the end we're all going to be raving about Jaron Ennis, and, you know, he's the next big thing in the welterweight division, a very talent-rich division, but, you know, he'll be making a big move with a win if he gets it on Saturday.
Crucible. There you go. Throwing writer words out there.
That's what I am, man.
See if Sergio can spell that next time we do a show together.
I love it.
So you mentioned the talent-rich welterweight division, and it is one of the strongest in boxing. What's the big fight that you think is available to Jaron Ennis over the next, let's say, 12 months? As he, you know, he beats Sergey Lipinets, he will position himself pretty strongly in somebody's rankings. He certainly will be, you know, rising up in, you know, marketability for sure. What's the big fight for Sergey Lipinets?
That's a really good question, because, you know, he's the kind of guy where I'm not sure the fighters with the belts are going to just give him a shot, just to give him the shot, because he's dangerous and he's not a big enough name where he's going to bring, you know, riches to the table. So he's the type of guy that's gonna have to work himself into a mandatory spot, in my opinion. I'm not suggesting that you know, guys with titles, you know, are ducking him necessarily, but it's like, what's the point? So what's in it for Errol Spence to fight a Jerron Ennis? He's got two titles, or Terrence Crawford at this point. Again, I'm not saying that they wouldn't fight him if it was the right situation, but so I don't think we're seeing him in a title fight at this point, unless, you know, a belt becomes vacant. So it's going to be up to his handlers to try to maneuver him into a mandatory to force one of the guys with the belts, or perhaps for a vacant title, to fight against him. So as far as who else is out there that doesn't have a title, again, the top names, you think of Danny Garcia is going to want to fight him? I doubt it. Danny's, you know, looking to move up to 154. So to answer the question is that's a good question. I really don't know the answer as far as, you know, who the big fight for him is. You have any ideas?
I have a wishful thinking idea, okay, and that's Virgil Ortiz. But
if you want to look at it like that, for sure. I mean, that would be great, but you and I have been around long enough to know,
correct,
that it's highly unlikely that would happen, because 2 years from now, that could be a pay-per-view mega fight, I mean, yeah, between these guys. You know, I mean, I'll throw this out there, you know, and it's not the first time this would have happened in the history of boxing where you want to measure against the other guy. When Maurice Hooker is ready to come back, does he get in the ring and take on a Jerron Ennis? You know,
oh, I don't think so.
Probably not. But
not,
you know,
not for a while.
If
not,
the money is right, you never know.
I think because Maurice has got that second fight with Golden Boy in his contract, I think Maurice is earmarked for something. And look, I think you and I have both written this. Alexis Rocha seems like the most likely guy for maybe if he gets through Rocha and he's a free agent once again, if the money's right, he could take on Jerron Ennis. But I feel like Maurice deserves kind of a break.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm racking my brains for fights that are doable, that make sense, that would be worth it for the opponent, that would be worth it for Ennis, that could bring Ennis, you know, still a decent name to improve his name recognition, I guess, with the boxing public. You know, that's why, you know, it's a good problem to have when you have a kid with that much talent. You know, I'd rather have a guy like that where you struggle to find a good fight for him than a guy that, you know, is not that good. And maybe you could find him to fight with anybody, but he's probably going to lose. So, you know, look, Ennis is just going to keep on doing his thing. Showtime likes him. They're putting him on a regular basis. And, you know, hopefully we'll see him if, you know, he's got to win Saturday. It's not like I don't think that, you know, a lot of people, I think it's relatively an easy fight. I don't think a lot of people agree with me about that. But let's see what happens on Saturday, and we'll assess it on Sunday morning.
I think it could be an easy fight. I think it'll be a fun fight, however long it lasts. And that's good news for Jerron Ennis, because he'll be more marketable after a fight like this. All right, let's talk about the ESPN fight this weekend. That is Joe Smith against Maxim Vlasov. This fight was originally scheduled to take place this past month. There was an issue, of course, with Vlasov and COVID going into that fight. It was postponed. Now here we are for the WBO light heavyweight title. Most people listening to this podcast, Dan, know about Joe Smith, like a very strong, durable, iron-fisted type of guy. When you look at Maxim Vlasov, are we looking at a tough fight here? Are we looking at a competitive fight for the light heavyweight title?
It could be tough. And the reason it could be tough is because Vlasov, you know, he's not going to outpunch Joe Smith, in my opinion. There's not too many light heavyweights out there that could outpunch him. I mean, you know, other than maybe Beterbiev, which might even be kind of even up in terms of the power. But Vlasov, you know, and Joe Smith, who I interviewed not that long ago for a piece that I wrote for the Ring Magazine's website, made the point, and he's absolutely right, because I've seen Vlasov fight several times. He likes to move a bit. It's not that he can't stand there and fight the guy, but he does like to use his legs and move around a little bit. So Joe might have to spend some time, at least in the early going, kind of hunting him down, maybe trying to fire to the body to tire him, you know, to get him to slow down a little bit. But Vlasov definitely knows how to box and can move. So that can make it a little bit complicated. The other thing is that Vlasov has got a lot of experience. I mean, Joe Smith's fought a lot of top guys, but so has Vlasov. Maybe people in the United States don't know a whole lot about him or haven't heard a lot about him, but he did go the distance in a fight against Zerto Ramirez. He didn't win, but it was a distance fight, and he didn't embarrass himself by any means. And the loss he had, or one of the losses he had, was a fight where he went up in weight and challenged for one of the cruiserweight titles. And again, did not embarrass himself, and was fighting a much bigger guy. And now is coming back, or has already come back down, and had other fights in the light heavyweight division. The one thing that does give me a little bit of pause, and I don't know what the situation was in terms of when Vlasov when he was supposed to fight Joe back in February. The reason that fight was postponed was because he was COVID positive, like I think right before the weigh-in or at the weigh-in, and they had to cancel the fight and postpone it till Saturday. If he had symptoms, if he was ill, you know, again, like we talked about with Povetkin and with Jamel Herring, like you just don't know how that's going to impact him physically. So if he has remnants of that situation and he's not 100%, then it could be an easier fight than maybe we even think for Joe Smith on Saturday. But Joe's the big favorite. You know, he's been talking about getting that title and bringing it back to Long Island, New York, and Top Rank is already in, you know, has no problem talking about matching him up. Joe Smith, that is, would better be up to unify three of the titles at the end of this year. They would probably do the, you know, when Bob Arum and I spoke about that, his thought was if Joe wins, you know, Arum, Joe DeGuardia, who's the other promoter, the longtime promoter for Joe Smith, they're on the same page. They're doing the better BF fight that Top Rank also promotes. That'll be later in the year. But if Vlasov wins, they would still do better BF against Vlasov. It just probably wouldn't be here in the United States. They would bring it overseas somewhere where they can bring a site fee in. But I don't think it's an easy fight, but I think it's a fight that Joe wins.
Yeah, couple things. One, you know, and you were on that media call with Joe Smith. I mean, he really is a Rocky Balboa type story. Like, he's still working. And, like, he looks at this title as his way not to work a 9-to-5 labor job. Like, it's wild. Like, he is a day-to-day labor. This isn't, like, just some shtick used to sell a fight that Joe Smith, the union worker. He's actually a union worker. And he's actually doing this on the regulars.
He has his own... I don't know if he's doing the day labor like he once was, where he's out there at the construction site with the... you know, the hammer and the nails and all that, but they have a tree business. And so he's like up in the trees, you know, sawing trees and cutting trees. And that's hard, intense labor. And as you said, he does not want to do that for the rest of his life. Now, the one thing he did between the time the fight was postponed in February until now is, and this shows you the guy's dedication. You know, he was engaged and they had planned their wedding to take place in the week after the fight when it was supposed to be in February. Then the fight got postponed, took a couple days off, had the wedding, took a few more days off, got right back in the gym. So, you know, he didn't go on a honeymoon. He didn't, like, you know, spend time, you know, writing thank you notes for the gifts and all that. He went right back to the gym and, you know, they can celebrate, I guess, more after he wins the title if he takes care of it on Saturday. But, you know, that's discipline. When you have a fight canceled like that, it takes so much out of you emotionally. You got to stay on weight. I'm sure he had a nice meal at the wedding. And then, you know, right back to the gym. So he's not had that honeymoon or that time to rest or that vacation. And he's been training for months because, you know, they weren't sure when the Vlasov fight was going to happen to begin with, even before it was scheduled for February. So, you know, Joe's had his eye on this for a long time. It's a big deal for him. It's a second opportunity. One of the things I wrote about, Chris, you know, he lost his first title shot against Bivol, who just completely outboxed him, took him apart, and really had easy, you know, an easy time with Joe. And I give Joe and that whole team for understanding that they didn't have to make crazy wholesale changes, but they had to do a couple things and refine his style, which is what his trainer Jerry did. And, you know, it's worked because he's looked really good in his two fights since then against Storm Alvarez and the other victory he had against, whose name escapes me, but another top guy, Jesse Hart. Those were two real solid victories for him. He was not as, like wild with his punches. They picked their shots much better, I felt like. And that was the thing that they talked about when I interviewed them. And we'll see if he can do it against Vlasov, who's a little bit more of a mover than those other guys.
Yeah, the lingering effects of COVID is a good point to make because I'm of the opinion, Dan, that the only way to beat Joe Smith is if you are in pristine condition and can outbox him for 12 rounds. Bivol's a good example. I don't think Joe Smith can ever beat Dmitry Bivol. They could fight 100 times and he would lose every single time because Bivol is just the worst possible matchup. He is finely conditioned, an excellent boxer with just enough power to keep you from coming in, just crashing at him and going for one of those big knockouts. Anybody else Joe Smith is in the game with, and I'm just not going to believe that Maxim Vlasov can last 12 rounds against this guy coming at him relentlessly until I actually see it. You make a good point that Vlasov has fought some good competition, maybe not necessarily as well known to us here stateside as some other fighters, but he has fought some solid competition. But Smith, to me, is an incredibly underrated fighter. I think he is going to go out there, apply relentless pressure, and in the 6th, 7th, 8th round, he's going to catch up to Vlasov. I think this has a lot of similarities to what we saw with Smith against Eleider Alvarez. I think it's that type of fight on Saturday.
That would not really surprise me at all. You know, as far as the effects of COVID-19, I'm just not sure. There's two different things. You know, there are certain people that get COVID and don't have any symptoms. Maybe they lose their taste or sense of smell, but they're not sick. And he might have just had a positive test. I'm not aware of whether he was ill or whether it was one of those deals where he was, asymptomatic, but just had it in his system. So if he did just had it in his system and wasn't sick, you know, maybe he'll be just fine. If he had it and is now, you know, spent some time recovering, it's hard enough to fight Joe Smith when you're perfect condition. Probably more so of a difficult night if you are a little diminished because you were sick.
If Smith wins, are you expecting it to be difficult to make Smith better, Biev, before the end of the year?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that fight will get made. You know, I mean, we don't know what the world's going to be like, but in terms of the boxing aspect of it, the business aspect of it, you know, I don't think there'll be a problem. COVID could intervene or whatever else might intervene, an injury or this and that. But in terms of the ability to make the fight, you know, Joe Smith and his trainer are on board with it. Joe DeGuardia is on board with it. Bob Arum is on board with it. I also interviewed Arthur Beterbiev prior to the fight against Adam Deans, and he said absolutely that's the fight he wants. He wants to win the other titles. So their side is on board with it. Top Rank is involved with both fighters. I don't think there'll be an issue. And as Bob Arum made the point, you know, as there are more people allowed in venues as the year goes on, as more people become vaccinated against COVID-19, they're starting to open up in New York. That's a place where they would put the fight. There's a large Russian community. Obviously, Joe has a big fan base that would want to come watch him from Long Island. That's the kind of fight that whatever the capacity is on the fight night is the kind of fight that could fill up Madison Square Garden to whatever the capacity level that they have. And that's what they need to do a fight like that because it's expensive to have another stream of revenue, which is tickets. And if they do the fight, you know, at the end of the year, I know, you know, let's say October, November, December, by that time, as capacity improves, you know, there'll be money there. There'll be a ticket buying public. And that's a big fight this sometimes gets lost on people. You cannot underestimate how important it is when you're making this caliber of fight that the athletes want the bout. And at least in my conversations, and again, in the last 2 weeks, I've had extensive interviews with both Beterbiev and with Joe Smith. The fights were discussed. They both said, absolutely, that's the fight they want.
Yeah, it's definitely a Madison Square Garden type of fight. And I know the NBA is saying that, you know, come next season, they're expecting full arenas. If you can get a full arena for an NBA game, you can get a full arena for a boxing match. And hopefully that's how it plays out in October, November. A couple things I want to run past you, Dan, before I let you go. You know, we're still kind of waiting for some resolution to the Fury-Joshua stuff. The reason I bring it up is because Tyson Fury took to social media and did what Tyson Fury does and applied pressure to the promoters involved by, you know, listing some kind of countdown 3 days. He put that out there on Wednesday. I mean, you and I were talking off the air. We're not entirely sure that Tyson Fury's math is accurate there. But, you know, look, this is what Fury does. He's putting pressure on the promoters to get a deal done. I mean, what do you think?
Well, like he did on social media, he put up a image of clocks, tick-tock, whatever, saying that, you know, and then he said, you got 3 days. And what he was referencing, it seems to me, is that when Anthony Joshua and Tyson signed whatever paperwork they signed, where it was like a big deal that supposedly the fight was signed, what was lost on some people, including some that reported about it, was that, yeah, okay, fine, they signed the fight, but what is in the paperwork was that deal was contingent. Again, this is all laid out in whatever they signed from what everybody who's involved has said to me and others, is that there was a 30-day time limit for which that the promoters had to secure I don't know the exact dollar figure, but basically like a 9-figure site deal to bring to Joshua and to Fury that they would each individually have to sign off on to have the guarantee for the money for the site. And that could be handled, then they would actually have a fight and they'd obviously have to produce paperwork that says this is real and we have the money. So they had 30 days to do it. Well, that 30 days, as Tyson Fury was making mention of on his social media posts, the time limit is nearly up. So again, like you and I were talking about off the air, is that we're not sure that Tyson's math is entirely correct because to my understanding, the paperwork was signed on Saturday, March 15th. They had 30 days, which would make it a month later. And he said 3 days when he posted it, whenever, like I think yesterday. And I think it was really still 5 days. But the point is, the time is running short for either Eddie Hearn or Frank Warren or Top Rank to bring a bona fide site deal to the table and get it squared away in time for them to say, we have a fight that we can put on, you know, presumably, as everybody has said, late June, early July. I just, I hope it gets done. You know, I think it's probably a good sign that we haven't heard that much from any of the promoters in the last, you know, few days, week. Even Eddie has really not been talking about it, and Eddie loves to talk about everything. But I also saw a thing, a video, I guess, John Fury, who was Tyson's father, did an interview with, I forget which outlet it was, so forgive me for not mentioning them. It was a British, I don't know if it was a TV channel or a YouTube channel, but John Fury did an interview and was making the point that they've got nothing, and he was making a, you know, kind of reading the riot act to Eddie Hearn about not delivering this on time, that basically, I believe the quote was, we have nothing. So it's all well and good to sign papers, but the papers that they signed, there's still things that the promoters had to deliver to make that be so we see the fight. So
yeah, and look, Dan, I saw that John Fury interview too. And look, Eddie Hearn and MTK, you know, they're running point on all this. But ultimately, isn't it on the fighters to decide if they're going to fight for X? I mean, there are offers on the table. They're just not the offers yet that Eddie Hearn and everyone are hoping for. I mean, I think, look, Eddie clearly believes that the longer you drag this out, the bigger the potential offer will be. And that makes some sense. I mean, COVID is slowly but surely starting to clear certain regions of the world. Look, he's starting to talk about the possibility of 100,000 in Wembley, and that being something that could be part of this equation. But if Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua want to fight, can't they just go to whoever it is and say, look, take the best offer. We'll fight for, if it's $75 million for a site fee, maybe we wanted 100, but we want the fight this bad, we'll take it. Isn't it ultimately on them?
I think that's a valid argument that you make. And let me tell you something. I know that they would like to have the fight in Wembley Stadium because it's the two British heavyweight champions, you know, in an all British undisputed heavyweight championship fight, which is, you know, a huge deal, especially in, you know, in the UK. But let me tell you something. You put 100,000 people in Wembley Stadium, that gate's still not going to be even remotely close to the 75 million or 100 million or whatever they could get out of, you know, the Middle East or some other exotic location, because the ticket prices in the Wembley Stadium, they just would not be able to charge enough to get to that level. I mean, I'll give you the example. When you were there, I was there, when Vladimir Klitschko fought in Wembley Stadium and challenged Anthony Joshua for his titles in 2017, there was 90,000 people there. It was one of the most unbelievable scenes I've ever seen in my life, going to boxing matches or anything else I've been to, other sports events or concerts. It was just incredible. Those 90,000 people produced a gate of probably around 12 to 15 million, and I'm probably overestimating it. So 100,000, yeah, is 100,000 people. That's a lot, but the money is not, it pales. I mean, I use the example of if the gate for Joshua against Klitschko was in that, you know, $10 to $15 million range, and they had 100,000. If you're the boxer, if you're the athlete who's getting paid on that, would you rather have 100,000 people in Wembley to do a gate of, like I said, $12-15 million? Would you rather be, you know, Triple G and Canelo, or I'll give you a better example, Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather, who fill up the MGM Grand about 16,500 ish, and the gate's 75 million? I mean, you have a fraction of the number of people, but massive amounts more of money. So in one sense, you're right. You know, that's why I don't think the fight happens in Britain, because the gate from the money standpoint, which seems so important to both of the athletes, you know, is destined to happen in another location where they can bring in more money. How much money is enough? I mean, look, Tyson Fury and Joshua have already both made, you know, nine figures in their careers. So I'm not begrudging them. They have to go in there and get hit and do the damage and take the damage. But when is enough enough? Like, at what point are you satisfied for life that you don't have to worry about the money? You know, I'm not telling them what to do, but, you know, if you really want to make the legacy, and that's what this fight is about, this is the big kahuna, you know, maybe the money should be slightly secondary. I'm not saying it's not important, but at the end of the day, for what they've already made, if the deal is $100 million, is your lifestyle going to change? Is anything about your life going to change if it's only like 80? No. Come on.
No, I mean, look, you can argue both sides, because I mean, there's a massive amount of money that they could get by waiting, but there are other reasons to take that fight sooner rather than later and go with what you have and do it potentially in front of an enormous crowd in one of the most spectacular settings ever in British boxing history. A couple things, other things here. Conor Benn, the son of Nigel Benn, he fights this weekend. Let me put the question this way. You know, Conor Benn is still a bit of an unknown as a boxer, had virtually no amateur background, has won some fights, undefeated as a pro, shown decent power. This is probably a step-up-ish type of fight against Samuel Vargas, though I'm getting a little bit tired of hearing about all the opponents Vargas has faced. He's beaten none of them. So it's like, you know, great, knocked out Amir Khan early in their fight. Fantastic. Then he lost a wide decision. Are you, put it this way, are you getting Tim Zhu type vibes off of Conor Benn, where you see a contender in the son of a former great? Or are you getting Chavez Jr. type of vibes off of Conor Benn, where, you know, maybe we might be looking at someone more pretender than contender?
I think it's possible to, you know, those are kind of like the opposite ends of the spectrum in today's game.
They are.
So I think that in the end, well, look, Chavez Jr. has become a joke, let's be honest. But at one time, when he won the middleweight belt that he won, which was against a substandard opponent, so that's a whole different conversation we'd have. But, you know, he ended up having some solid fights against decent guys. He did beat, for example, an Andy Lee, a very good victory, as one of the examples. But in terms of his overall totality of his career, it's been a disaster. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have, like you mentioned, Tim Zhu, who's coming off a win about a week or so ago against Dennis Hogan. You know, and I've been a fan of Tim Zhu since I first saw him fight at, you know, 7-0 maybe or something like that. I think that you know, he was on my most recent prospect list at the end of 2019. You know, a really outstanding prospect who has been looking good and getting better and better. I believe that Conor Benn is probably somewhere in between those two. You know, I don't get the Zhu vibe yet, because I think that Zhu's definitely going to be a world champion, but I think he has a chance to maybe in the totality of a career, you know, be a more consummate professional and quality fighter than Chavez Jr. You know, you can say what you want about Vargas, Samuel Vargas, his opponent that's going to be in the ring with him on Saturday. And yes, he has lost when he stepped up, but it's been against the top guys. So it is, again, it's like a measuring stick. Yes, I know he lost those fights against Errol Spence and Danny Garcia and Amir Khan and, you know, whoever. But you still want to see how does Ben perform against that level of guy, because Vargas, whatever his failings are, he's very experienced. He knows what he's doing inside the ring. And if he goes in there and he gives Conor Benn a tough time, then maybe you sort of lean towards the Chavez end of the spectrum. But if Conor Benn goes in there and gets rid of him, you know, in impressive fashion, or just, you know, completely shuts him down and wins, you know, a lopsided decision, you know, you give the kid credit for that. So my instinct says he needs more seasoning. He's not quite ready for the bigger names and taking those steps up just yet. That it's still more of a work in progress, but he's still a young guy. You know, give him maybe after the Vargas fight, you know, you might still want to think about giving him three or more fights and then make the big move. But I like what I see so far, you know. I like what I see.
Yeah, look, Vargas will bang with him. We know that from watching Vargas's fights. And look, if Conor Benn dispatches him in the way that Errol Spence did, the way Danny Garcia did, the way that Virgil Ortiz just did and stops him during this fight, maybe that'll sway my opinion on Conor Benn. But right now, I think the jury is very much still out. Last thing for you, Dan. And I bring this up just kind of on the fly here because I was reading yet another quote from our good friend Eddie Hearn. I love to poke Eddie every so often about this because it's funny because Eddie has been trying to make Devin Haney versus Ryan Garcia for a year now. I mean, basically forever. Like, he promotes Devin Haney. He wants Haney to get sort of the shine off a win over Ryan Garcia. And Eddie's out there basically pleading with anyone to put pressure on Ryan Garcia to fight Devin Haney. I would say this first, and let me know if you agree with this. If Eddie was promoting Ryan Garcia, he would not be advising him to fight Devin Haney. Like, he just wouldn't. Like, it's not Ryan Garcia, his popularity is on a different level than Devin Haney right now. And there is no real push to have Garcia fight Haney. Like, I think the boxing people think it's a great fight, but the masses at large, I don't think they know enough about it. And Haney, as I've said in recent broadcasts, like, just hasn't done enough to kind of push that fight more into the forefront. I just, you know, these decisions and the way he fought against Yuri Gamboa, to me, that doesn't create a mandate to see Haney versus Garcia. What do you think?
I think that I totally understand what Eddie's trying to do because, you know, he's a promoter. He's doing his job. You know, if you can get your guy some shine by mentioning the other guy, even if the fight doesn't happen, that's still a positive for Devin Haney, because then Eddie can say, look, you know, I've got the WBC lightweight champ and he's the interim champ and they should be fighting. And, you know, he doesn't want to take this, you know, fight, and, you know, and he can drum up interest like that. But I understand that, you know, Haney, he's a very talented fighter. I'm very high on him. I've been watching him for a long time. You know, he's outstanding, but a matchup between Garcia and Haney is not the one that the fans in the, you know, of boxing are demanding. There are, you know, other fights in the lightweight division that could involve other guys, whether it's a Tank Davis or it's a Teofimo Lopez, the champ in there, you know, or Ryan Garcia or Devin Haney. So I'd love to see the fight, but I understand it's not a huge money fight right now. I think it's a very complicated fight for Ryan Garcia, even though I have the utmost respect for his talents as well as Haney. I just think style wise at this moment in time, you know, it's a real complicated, difficult fight, and the risk reward factor, you have to take that into account. And right now, it doesn't match up because the risk is not outweighed by what the reward is for that fight. So I don't think that's going to happen right off the bat. Ryan Garcia has bigger names in his mind. But look, they both have interesting fights coming up because Ryan has a fight with Javier Fortuna, who's maybe not the A-level contender, but he's a solid lightweight, been around for a while, you know, he's got a lot of experience, has some nice wins. You know, and Haney's got the fight with Linares coming up. After those fights, if both of them do what they're supposed to do and they win impressively, maybe then there'll be more of a drumbeat to see those guys fight. Because, look, it is a fight that can be forced by a sanctioning body because of the WBC having Haney as their champion and as Ryan as their interim champion. But
well, we both know Ryan doesn't give a shit about that belt.
No, understood. They can at least exert some pressure, and, you know, you never know. But Ryan's going to do what Ryan's going to do, and Ryan wants big fights. And, you know, title or no title, he's the bigger name. He's the bigger draw. You know, he's the one that put, you know, whatever, 12,000 in the arena in Anaheim.
Anaheim, not long ago.
So, you know, Haney may have the belt, but, you know, there's no doubt that in the promotion, in the fans out there, that Garcia is the A side of that. And, you know, so Eddie's doing what he's supposed to. He's doing his job, is what I can say. And,
look, there's Dan, like, if, and you kind of touched on this, if Haney goes out and knocks out Jorge Linares, which is very doable, whenever Jorge Linares loses, he gets knocked out.
Yeah.
If he knocks out Jorge Linares and does it in like the third round of that fight, and then Garcia goes out and knocks out Fortuna, which is, again, very possible. Mm-hmm. I think then there will be some momentum. I disagree with Eddie as well when Eddie said a crowd doesn't really matter. Of course it does. Like, Ryan Garcia is emerging as a major ticket seller in Southern California. You put Ryan in Southern California against Devin Haney in November, December, it probably sells between 12 and 15,000 tickets. He's become that big a deal. So I think the pressure really, Dan, is more on Devin Haney. If he goes out and just wipes the mat over 12 rounds with Jorge Linares, there will be no buzz for a Ryan Garcia fight, no matter what Ryan does over the summer. But if he goes out there and flattens Linares and looks impressive, I think the public interest will start to build to a point where we are likely to see that fight before the end of the year.
I'm not sure I would say likely, but it definitely will have a better chance of happening. But like you said, what Devin Haney has to do, he's got to win, however it happens. But in a perfect world, it's not a 12-round sort of, you know, mechanical decision where he just outboxes the guy. It should be more like what he did to Antonio Moran, fight that was near at the casino near where I live, where he knocked him out in, you know, four or five rounds or whatever it was. But I had it as the knockout of the year. I mean, just absolutely pummeled him in the knockout. It was a devastating knockout. So for all the people out there that think that Devin Haney is just a, you know, touch and go type of fighter that just box and move and outpoint you, outslick you, don't make that mistake. That dude can, you know, if he hits you the right way, you're going, man. Devin Haney should not be underestimated as a puncher. He may not be as dynamic a puncher as a Teofimo or as a Tank Davis or even as Ryan, but trust me, Devin Haney can punch. Mm-hmm.
I agree. I think he's got it within him. He's just got to be willing to take a risk or two during these fights. And if he does, big things could be ahead for him at the end of the year. Dan, always great to talk to you, man. Check out Dan on Twitter @DanRaphael1. Subscribe to his newsletter there. It's excellent. I read it every single day and read Dan's stuff over at Boxing Scene and RingTV.com. We'll see you at the next one, Dan.
Look forward to it, Chris. Thanks, man.
When we come back, my conversation with Jamel Herring.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait!
Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Now, I'm supposed to talk here about what I remember and what I loved about my first car. And that's easy for me to do because I still have my first car. And as long as it keeps running, and so far so good, I intend to have that car probably until the day I die. That's how much I love that car. It is like a child to me. Now, it does require some upkeep, and that's why I'm grateful for a place like eBay Motors. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. All right, Jamel Herring is here. 130-pound champion. Still 130-pound champion after stopping Carl Frampton this past weekend. Let me start here, Jamel. What was more satisfying to you, winning the world title or defending it against the kind of opponent and on the kind of stage you defended it on?
Oh, the latter. Defending it against the kind of the opponent that Frampton was and what he had on his resume. And that's the reason why I wanted the fight. You know, I needed that marquee name. I didn't want to be that guy that, yeah, I made some defenses, but who did I fight? Who did I beat? So that meant more. I mean, like I said, of course, winning that world championship, for you know, it obviously is a great feeling, but to defend it in a big fight where people actually thought you couldn't win to begin with, is obviously the better feeling.
Did you feel that over the last couple of weeks that, you know, whether it was the odds makers who initially had you as the underdog, a lot of people in the media, you know, thought Frampton was the favorite. Could you feel that?
I seen it, but it didn't really bother me because I know me, you know, I knew how hard I was working in camp. The main thing, it just lit more of a fire and it just kept me on my P's and Q's like, hey, you got to be focused. You got to go in there and take this fight more seriously than any fight you ever had because they're already, you already have your back against the wall. They're already doubting you. They're already ready to sail you away and send you off. So if anything, it just made me sharper, but it wasn't so much as like pressure to where I was nervous or doubting myself. But just like I said, it just made me more hungry.
I think one of the reasons that people were picking against you was the Okendo fight and how it played out for you. What was the difference between you against Okendo and you against Carl Frampton?
Me against Carl Frampton, I was healthier. I wasn't still feeling all the effects from the COVID situation. I mean, we just seen a recent story. It's funny. I just seen a story recently with for Beckham when he basically said that his performance was due to him coming off COVID and the way he looked. And it was no excuse. So that's why it didn't really bother me because I knew personally what was wrong with the whole Okendo fight. Like my body just wasn't reacting well to anything. It was a rough fight on top of that. But I pretty much knew, and that's why it wasn't so much like, man, I had a bad performance. Maybe I don't do so well against Frampton. Like, no, I knew what was wrong. And I'm like, okay, once I get back to my old self, then we'll see the real Jamel and how I look, and I'll go based off of that.
Yeah, and look, you bring it up. Povetkin, you know, you could tell in that fight was not the same fighter. I think he got more of the benefit of the doubt than you did. In that fight. Maybe it was because you could visibly see Povetkin not having the right equilibrium, not being able to have any kind of punch resistance. I don't think people gave you the benefit of the doubt there when it came to the impact of COVID.
I mean, yeah, but I look at it like this. If you really look at it, Chris, it kind of benefited me in the end. Because, you know, I remember in the friendly fight, I got cut similar fashion. And I know everyone was saying, here we go again. You know, so you know that was coming up in people's minds. How will he react? Even when I actually, for the first time yesterday, I watched the fight and just listened to, you know, Andre and Tim. They wanted to see, you know, what my mental state was. So it was kind of like a blessing in disguise because, okay, I was in a similar situation. But you clearly seen I handled it a lot better with a better opponent that was, in my opinion, was more hungrier than O'Kendall. Because remember, Carl Frampton, the whole buildup around the fight was basically him becoming Ireland's first three divisional world champion. So that was, you know, he was motivated. He had something to really fight for. But, you know, I handled it well, and I proved that, you know, I still have a lot to offer.
When you feel that cut above your eye, right around, I believe, the same place, what are you thinking?
I said, you know what, just stay calm, stay cool, because more importantly, if I show that, you know, that I'm folding under the pressure, a smart fighter like Frampton, he's gonna pick up on that. And I'd rather, you know, at the time I was boxing really well, and I wanted to keep that same composure to basically show that I wasn't bothered. Because, I mean, common sense, if I see a fighter and he's cut and he's showing that he's bothered by it, I'm gonna jump over him as well. So my main thing was just focusing on what was in front of me. And I for a second, I couldn't take my eye off the prize and give that window for Frampton to take fully advantage of the opportunity.
You were clearly the stronger fighter in this matchup. I mean, could you feel that right away? I mean, as you guys started to go at it, you could just tell. I mean, Frampton is a 122 coming up to 130. You're a 135 right, coming down to 130, who's right, clearly right, comfortable at that weight. Could you feel your strength advantage in the ring?
I definitely felt it, especially with the first. If you look back, I think it was like the first straight left hand to the body, and I seen how he reacted to it. And any fighter could tell you, no fighter likes getting hit to the body. We all come across fighters, even journeymen, that have great chins. But if you really beat a fighter down to the body, that you'll see how he really reacts to things. And I can see that just from you know, his body language, that I was definitely the stronger guy. And remember, you know, this is a man that the whole buildup, he was like, I remember from the beginning of the fight being made, he was saying that he had the power in any round to basically stop me. He was the better fighter. There was no way, even for my size, I could be physically stronger than him. So, you know, he had a lot of confidence building inside. But, you know, it was my job to take that hurt from him in the very beginning. And you can tell, because, I mean, this is a guy who we've seen against, you know, my good friend McCreary, who was bigger than him also. And Carl was taking it to him round after round. So, and I knew he had in mind that, you know, they probably thought I wasn't that strong, and that he could do a similar, you know, game plan like he did against McCreary. And I just believed in me, and I knew that I was just, you know, the better fighter overall in terms of, he said he was faster than me. I think I got to him quicker with the punch. I had more rhythm. My footwork was better, because there were times when he did try to press and I could easily change directions. Mm-hmm. And I just want to prove that I was just better in all aspects and not just rely solely on, you know, my size, which people thought I was going to do, just rely on my, you know, my height and my reach and all my weight. No, I want to prove that I'm just a better fighter overall.
Well, there's a lot of talk too coming in that, you know, Frampton's best way to succeed was to get on the inside against you. Yet when he did get on the inside, because you could hear everything in that empty arena, right, you could hear Bomack screaming, rough him up, you know, like, you know, get physical with him. I mean, it seemed like you were just as comfortable as he was with an inside fight.
Oh yeah. Because like I said, Chris, that was common sense. We knew his only advantage to potentially winning the fight was for him to get on the inside. Even though he said it in plenty of interviews that he had the better jab and that he can easily just outbox me, I knew that wasn't the case. I'm like, maybe that's just him bluffing for me to try to bait into that. But I knew that if he wanted to be successful, he had to basically get on the inside. And We work for that. That's why we had the guys like Terrence Crawford come to camp, because Bud wasn't there to box with me. No, Bud was there to make it uneasy for me and make it really uncomfortable in the trenches and have those firefights. And I had to basically fight my way out to go back to my natural state, which is boxing, of course. But that's the reason why we brought guys in like Bud, because we wanted for him to try to bully me around. And you've seen it. Frankly, tried to bully me around, and I just wasn't having any part of it.
It's nice when you can bring a pound-for-pound guy in just to get you that kind of work. It's hard to get much better than that. You're in a position now, Jamel, where you know there's money out there for you. There's opportunity out there for you. You immediately started talking about Oscar Valdez, and I can see that being an excellent fight. I mean, Valdez coming off the biggest win of his career against Burchelt, you coming off the biggest win of your career. However, I'm not so sure you're going to be able to do it with that WBO title. Where do you stand on that? If the WBO says Shakur Stevenson or vacate and you still want to fight Valdez, what do you do?
Let me just say, for starters, I just want to say, you know, I love and respect Paco and WBO, because when I fought Ido for the title, I wasn't the mandatory. And they still, you know, they allowed me to, you know, have that opening window to live my dream. And winning your first world title is always going to be big to you. And they gave me that opportunity. So, you know, I always have a special place in my heart for the WBO and Paco. But I'm at a stage where, you know, I also want to fight for my own legacy. And even if even if they do take the title, I still see the Valdez fight still outweighs more, because Chris, like, we could potentially fight for the lineal championship. Every world champ, we live in an era of boxing where we've seen champions with multiple titles, unified champions. They're not the lineal. They're not considered the lineal champion. You know, everyone can't have that Covenant Ring Magazine title, which I really want. And it still gives me opportunity to fight for another major world title, which is the WBC title. So, I mean, if you weigh out the options, what would you do? I mean, would you fight for your own legacy? And I also feel that from the rough year that I've had, and if I can go still, you know, I put on an impressive win against Frampton and do a similar fashion with Oscar Valdez, that has to put me at least in the running or conversation of Fighter of the Year. And, you know, in 2019, I was Ring Magazine's Comeback Fighter of the Year. Just imagine 2 years later, I could be becoming the Fighter of the Year. That's just a lot for my career. And that will also start to create a conversation with me down the road being in the Hall of Fame myself, even this late in my career. So I look at the ladder and what is big for me in terms of my career overall. And I don't want to give up my title, but if I have to, you know, I'll respect the decision, because at the same time, the WBO, you know, my boy Shakur, they've been patient. They have been patient, because let's be honest, this fight was being postponed so many times. People thought, was it going to happen? People thought the fight was cursed. But, you know, things happen for a reason. But I still was, you know, choose the Valdez fight over anything first.
I think you've been hanging around Joe Test too long with the lineal stuff. Joe Test loves him some lineal. Loves him some lineal talk. My man Joe Test.
Think about it, though. We live in an era where I got my good friend Errol Spence and Terrence Crawford. We've been dying to see that fight for the last 2-3 something years now. Mm. And we're nowhere close to getting that fight. But if we have a chance to see champion versus champion with me and Valdez, you have to go for it, because it's rough. And, you know, there's too many politics and with this side and who's on this side of the street. But if I have that window if we can make a good fight that people want to see now, I'd rather go for that, you know, because the way boxing goes today, like I was saying to somebody earlier, titles, as you can see, they switch hands like that now. Like when coming into 2021, you had me, JoJo Diaz, and Burchelt all with our belts intact. One thing or another, you know, JoJo, he lost his title because of the whole weight situation. Mm-hmm. Burchelt lost his title to Oscar Valdez in a fight that people actually gave Valdez less of a chance of winning than me beating, you know, Frampton. So that boxing, it changes that quickly. So if I have the opportunity, I got to go for it.
No, I agree. And look, I mean, there's no reason that, you know, the winner of Valdez versus you couldn't fight Shakur in 2022. Like, that's just another massive fight.
That's what I said. I always say, I love Shakur, but, you know, he has time on his side. We don't, you know, in terms of my situation, I don't have that. You know, I'm at the stage where, like, where Bernard Hopkins, 35 years old, his best friend came against Felix Trinidad. You know, I look at guys that I admire, Winky Wright. It took him years to get those big fights. When he got the opportunity, he took it. When he fought, you know, Shane Mosley, who I admire also, you know, he took the opportunity. So if I have the opportunity to fight another champion, like when Winky Wright fought Shane, when Shane was the champion, well, they both had titles, but Shane, you know, he was the man. Why not I take advantage of that and go fight another champion to you know, further, you know, pad my own resume with, you know, champion, fighting champion, champion, champion.
You know, and talking to you right now, Jamel, I mean, I remember you after the Oquendo fight, you were pretty down. Like, you know, a lot of the stuff that was said and written, like it sort of took a toll on you mentally, to the point where you were talking about, maybe I'll retire, maybe Frampton will be my last fight. You seem reinvigorated right now. Maybe that's what a huge win will do for you, but you seem reinvigorated, and not to say you're looking to fight into your 40s, but you seem to think you have, you know, some good fights ahead of you.
Oh yeah, I definitely do. I definitely do, because I just needed the rest. And Chris, you know, I'm active on social media, so you see I'm always a fan of the sport. And when I see all these other good fights, I'm like, man, I want to be a part of something big myself. And if I have the opportunity, and because, you know, I live right. I'm not out here. Like right now I'm home and I'm resting. I'm not out here partying in clubs, celebrating because of my big win. No, I'm already, not even a week later, I'm already looking forward to the next big thing. You know, I always say to myself, I'll rest and celebrate when I'm done. But right now, I'm all about business. I want to take care of business. I don't, you know me, Chris, I was willing to go to Belfast for this fight. I was willing to go to London for this fight, because I still believed in me. Even with everything after the Oquendo fight, you would think that I would have shied away from making that fight, where people would probably thought it was the wrong idea or a dangerous fight for my career, to where I would have basically, you know, been handing my title to Frampton. But I knew what was going on with in terms of the Oquendo situation. But yeah, and it showed. Like, I just believed in me. But now I'm looking at the, you know, I'm grateful and I'm still excited about, you know, my huge victory. But I want more. There's more. Because I love when people always say, well, yeah, the Frampton was this, but what about, you know, you won't get away with this when I ask about this. Okay, then bring it on. Like, then let me get that fight. Because you know me, Chris, I love proving people wrong. And just like I did with the Oquendo situation, they thought I was done, and I proved them wrong there. I then with Frampton, the third Frampton had, because he had all the experience, it was going to be an easy night for Frampton, and he was going to show that I didn't belong in the same class as him. I love the man to death, but you can pretty much say I retired the man, you know. And now what Oscar about is he brings a lot, but with me, that thing that I really want is, I can say that I took that O. I can be the first man to take, you know, to take that undefeated record from him. So that's what also, you know, boosts me up for this fight. And I'm actually, you know, it doesn't take much for me to get ready to get back in the gym. Like, once this little scar or whatever heals up, send me back to camp. Just let me go. Let me go. And like I say, even at my age, I still have that fire and that hunger.
Always the underdog, man. You wrote another chapter in your terrific story this past weekend over in Dubai. Congratulations, Jamel, and looking forward to whatever it is you got coming next.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you.
Coming up next, my conversation with Jerron Ennis. All right, so this has already been the year of the step-up fight. In January, we had Ryan Garcia knocking out Luke Campbell. In March, it was Virgil Ortiz stopping Maurice Hooker. And on Saturday, Jerron Ennis will get his chance to make a statement when he faces Sergey Lipinets, the former 140-pound title holder. That's a fight that you can see live on Showtime. And Jerron joins me here on the show. So is that a fair way to put it, Jerron? Like, this is kind of the year of the step-up fight for you young, you know, future stars.
I mean, yeah, you can see that, you know, everybody getting the opportunity to fight great opponents, and this is going to help us get to the next level.
Is there any kind of, you know, natural competitiveness in you when you look at your peers with the younger guys, whether it is a Ryan Garcia or a Virgil Ortiz or anybody else kind of age 25 and under coming up the ranks?
No, I focus on myself. I don't really worry about nobody else. I just focus on myself and how I'm a better myself and how me and my team going, you know, prepare ourselves to get ready for our fight each and every time we go
so
out.
So what's that been about then? You know, focusing on yourself, making, you know, getting yourself better. What's been the keys for that?
Just staying locked in and, you know, working on things with my team and, you know, we ready to rock and roll, able to, man. We can't wait.
So every time I talk to people around you, I hear a lot of the same thing. It's hard to get guys to fight you. It's hard to get guys in the ring to face you. Have you noticed that? I mean, has it been hard to get big fights?
I mean, most definitely it's been hard to get big fights. And I finally got my opportunity, you know, this Saturday. And I've been waiting probably for like two and a half years. Just to even get in the ring with a former world champion or a top 10 or a top 5 guy or elite guy, period. And this is my opportunity, and I can't wait to, you know, do my thing and make my dreams come true and you know, boost my ratings up and do it in a spectacular fashion on Saturday night.
So take me back a little bit before we get to Lippin Yetz. You grew up in Philadelphia, Fighting City. Who did you grow up watching?
Besides my brothers and my dad, everybody know I grew up watching Roy Jones and Pernell Whitaker and Floyd.
So, I mean, very, very different. Well, at least Roy and Pernell, very different types of fighters.
I mean, kind of similar in some way because younger Roy was coming up. He was hard to hit. People couldn't really hit him. You know, he was using his feet very well, and you know, CP has great footwork, so they kind of like similar but different at the same time. So I get where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, well, Roy, I mean, the speed of Roy Jones in his day, I think even younger people even forget, and you clearly don't because you watched him, but I think people forget just how fast Roy Jones was and how good he was in the 1990s.
Yeah, exactly. Roy Jones' speed was dominating. It was just incredible. And, you know, his speed was power. He really had to really sit down on no punches. And it was the shots that the guys didn't see that knocked the guys out. So, you know, it was always fun watching Roy Jones Jr. You know, I still watch him to this day. Probably going to watch him in a little bit. So,
do you feel like you've taken some of that, you know, and try to incorporate that into your own game? I mean, what you say, you're right. Like, the punches people don't see are often the most impactful.
Definitely. The shots that they don't see is the ones that always knock them out or hurt them. So, you know, and that's the things I look for when I watch, you know, Roy Jones, see what shots that he hit that guy with that he didn't see. Even with Floyd, the same thing with Floyd and Sweet Pea. You make a certain move and you, and the shot right there, and they don't see you. So, you know, and you throw the shot, and next thing you know, they hurt. So you just got to be smart and pick your shots. And that's what I've been watching and stealing from those guys and, you know, stealing from my brothers and my dad too. So it's just been great to be able to watch those guys.
So you mentioned your family, and you are from a fighting family with your brothers and your father. What was it like growing up in that type of household? How important and how big was boxing back then?
I feel like boxing is bigger now than it was back then, but it was always great. It was always a great vibe, and being around my family, you know, getting to see my brothers spar top guys and fight top guys, and you know, it was number three in the WBC. Derek Poulinas was number three in the WBC, and Farah was like number two or number four in the IBF. So they was right there. They was contenders, and you know, they was right there, and it was always great to see those guys, see my brothers fight in Philadelphia and on TV. And I was like, I just want to be like my brothers when I get older. And now I'm doing it.
Was watching your brothers, was that what made you want to get into boxing?
I mean, I always was into boxing, but at one point I was boxing and playing basketball at the same time. And probably from when I was about like 9 or 10 to about 13, and I had stopped playing basketball, and it wasn't, you know, as fun as it was for me as boxing was. And boxing always been fun for me as long as I've been doing it. It never got boring or old with me. So it just, once I stopped playing basketball and, you know, took boxing a little more serious, it just was only up. And I was only, you know, that's when I started winning nationals and going to, you know, Team USA, going to training camp and stuff like that. And, you know, and eventually turning pro and, you know, going 26-0 and being 24 knockouts and playing on Showtime. And so I benefit and got a lot of things from, you know, coming up and seeing a lot of things from my family and being in tournaments and stuff like that.
How influential was your dad in your kind of making boxing your thing?
My dad was very he was very influential in, you know, getting me to box and stuff like that. But he never like forced me to box. He just let me have fun with it, and he still let me have fun with it to this day. So he never forced it on me and all that. So that's what he did.
So back in 2016, you came about as close as you can get to making that Olympic team, losing that box off to Gary Antoine Russell. How tough was that moment for you to not get to that Olympic level?
I mean, it wasn't really tough because I already know they had they picks in already for who they wanted to go to the Olympic team. To the Olympics and stuff. So, I mean, I really wasn't too worried about it. You know, it was perfect timing for me. I wound up turning pro that next probably like couple months or so. And, you know, just look where I'm at now and you know, look where they at. So
I don't think I've ever met anyone that's had a good experience with Olympic boxing. I feel like every experience is bad.
I feel like it's great to win it, you know, win a medal or any kind. It helped you in turning pro and stuff like that, but I feel like I always wanted to turn professional anyway. I really didn't want to go to the Olympics anyway. I just, you know, it was just an opportunity and it presented itself. So I was trying to take it and go to the next level with it. But, you know, things happen and, you know, they like to rob. Hello?
Yeah, good. No, go ahead.
Oh, you know, things happen and, you know, they like to take, you know, take fights from away from kids when they coming up and stuff like that. So you just got to live with it. It's amateur boxing.
Yeah, no, I've heard so many stories just like that of guys frustrated with that whole system in general. But you did mention opportunity. I mean, did you struggle with that at first to kind of get, whether it's promoters or managers, interested in to let them understand just exactly what kind of talent that you were?
No, we had no problem. They was actually trying. A lot of guys were actually trying to make me turn pro when I turned 16. He was trying to make me turn pro and stuff like that. We had a lot of people coming at me and trying to sign me and stuff like that. But, you know, we just waited it out, took our time with it. And, I mean, I'm kind of glad we waited it out because I'm in a great position right now. And, you know, it's almost time for me, you know, be a world champion soon.
Yeah, and look, I don't know how you would have done at the Olympics. You're certainly talented. But it does seem to me like you have, you know, just a pro style, man. Like, you see a lot of young guys that – when they come out of the Olympic, like Teofimo Lopez is a great example. I watched him in Rio and got beat in the first round and he comes out and, you know, performs incredibly well at the pro level. There are just some guys that you can tell are just pros. Do you feel like that's always been you, that the pro style has been a better fit than the amateur style?
I mean, yeah, I always had a pro style because, you know, coming up, that's all I used to see. And that's all I used to train with was pros. And all I used to spar with was pros. So I developed a pro style early and, you know, I never really threw too many punches, a lot of punches as an amateur, but I always, my shots was always accurate and I always was like hurting guys, getting an 8 count or stopping guys. So, you know, just, yeah, I definitely always had a pro style and I did want to turn pro when I was like 16, but I waited it out.
That might have been a little too early. You might have had to go down to Mexico or something to start doing some of those fights. When Sergey Lipinets is brought to you as an opponent, what's your reaction?
Thank you. Just thank you. And I was excited because I've been waiting for these type of fights forever. It's been 2 years, maybe 2.5 years, and I finally got a guy that's a former world champion, and he's a top guy. So it's the perfect timing. It's my time, and I can't wait. And it's just going to be a great night on Saturday night.
Did you watch his fight against Peterson?
No, I didn't watch his fight. I don't really watch.
You don't. This is what every time I read something about you, somebody asks you, like even the Virgil Ortiz fight. I was going to ask you about that later, but I read a clip where you're like, "Nah, I went to sleep. I was asleep for that fight."
Yeah, I mean, I'm in camp, so I really don't really do too much. I come home, you know, I train 2 and 3 times a day. So I come home, you know, I'd be tired. I get in the shower and lay down. And next thing you know, it's time to do it again tomorrow. So, you know, I don't really watch too much TV or anything. I play the game here and there while I'm in camp, but most of the time I'm asleep, getting my rest, you know, trying to be well prepared for the next day.
So do you come from that school of, you know, your opponent is your opponent, but if you do what you do well, you're going to be successful? I mean, Floyd kind of had that mentality a lot. Not that he ignored his opponent's strengths, but like he felt the best of him was better than the best of anybody else. Do you have that same kind of mindset?
Yeah, you put it right in perfect words. Just the same type of mindset. It's not that I'm ignoring it. It's just that not every fighter fights the same. Just because he fought a guy one way, don't mean he's going to fight me the same way. So, like I always say, you got to prepare yourself all the way around the board. And that's what we do. But I know he's going to be right in front of me and try to walk forward. And it's just going to be a long night for him, you know. I can't wait to put on this dominating, crushing. I want to put on a punishing performance and then get the knockout later on.
No, I'm very into this fight for that reason, because if Lipinets is what we saw against Mikey Garcia, what we saw against Lamont Peterson, he is going to be right there in front of you looking to trade it out. And as I see you smiling there, I'm not so sure that's the best best strategy with you so far. This is obviously it's a big fight, a big name for you to take on. Is there a path, do you think, for you to get into that welterweight title picture in the next, you know, 8 months, 12 months, 16 months, whatever it is? Do you see that path?
Definitely. I feel like this the one right here. I said this the one that's going to put me on to that next level. And after I do my thing this Saturday and I do it in a spectacular fashion, and I make a big statement to the welterweight division in the boxing world, period. And this will just boost my ratings, my rankings up, just everything, superstardom, just maybe even towards a pay-per-view star one day. So this is the time right here for me to show out, be dominant, be great, and come home with a big knockout. And then it's on to bigger and better things. It's, you know, maybe a top three guy next time I fight, or a top five guy, and then maybe a world title at the end of the year. So hopefully that's how I go. And, you know, It's time.
Do you feel like you're going to have to force your way into that title picture by mandatory? Because your skill is high level, and I'm not so sure, you know, the title holders, only three of them, maybe only two before the end of the year. Do you feel like you're going to have to force your way in as a mandatory?
I mean, you could say that, but I feel like me winning this Saturday, there's no way they could deny me, and it should put me right up there with the top of the top. And I feel like I should be right there. So, but I definitely see where you're coming from, and maybe I might have to be a mandatory. I don't think one of the champions will just pick me and be like, I'm gonna fight him. So maybe I will have to be a mandatory, but I mean, I'm fine with that. You got to work your way up to be a world title holder. So that's what I'm doing right now, and it's the start of it.
All right, I'm gonna ask you one more thing, because I am ready, Jerron, to start beating the drum for Jerron Ennis versus Virgil Ortiz. I'm ready, man. Like, I am ready. I know people are going to say, wait, let it marinate, all that bullshit, but I am ready for that fight to happen at some point in the next 18 months. Give it 18 months. Can we see Ennis versus Ortiz at some point before the end of 2022?
Like I always say before, everybody always asks me this question, and I say the same thing. All they got to do is call. All they got to do is call, and ain't hard to find me, and you know I don't turn down nothing.
I feel like Virgil says the same thing though. Like he's the same kind of guy. Like I'm not turning down fights. I love big fights.
Yeah. Right. I mean, well, as he should. You know, he's a good up and coming fighter, and you know, But at the end of the day, all they gotta do is call. And, you know, I'm one phone call away.
Do you have any history with him?
No, I don't have no history with him. No, none at all.
No amateur cross wrath or anything like that?
No, I don't remember him from the amateurs or anything. But he just popped out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And no. Yeah.
I'm sure you get asked about that all the time, but I mean, after watching Virgil Ortiz from ringside last month and watching you come up the ranks and looking forward again to what you're going to do or what you're attempting to do on Saturday, I mean, that to me is like, can't miss. Like, just, you can't miss with a fight like that.
Yeah, definitely. That'd definitely be a great fight, and I can't wait to make it happen. Yeah. I'm one phone call away.
Love to see it. Love to see it. Well, Jaron, good luck on Saturday. You against Sergey Lipinets. You can watch that on Showtime. It's going to be a great fight, man. Looking forward to your future success and everything you got coming, man.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. My thanks to my guests. As always, subscribe to the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. Rate, review. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.